KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
In Seattle.
Let there be wild animals. Let there be animals that crawl on their bellies. Let there be small dogs whose owners dress them in sweaters at Christmas time. And God said, it's a little bit weird, but nevertheless.
I'm convinced that sales, whether it's traditional sales or whether it's this non-sales selling, has changed more in the last 10 years than in the last 100.
I still think we're in our act three of a Shakespearean drama, and until we have all the facts, I think that we should wait and see to truly know what's going on.
Steve Hansen, a Sacramento City Council member, talking about the sale of the possible sale or the Kings leaving. We don't really know, but we're going to talk a little bit about what it means to Seattle when we open up our chat room. We heard from Dan Pink. He talks about sales and how sales have changed in our culture. And Rob Bell, who uses humor and much more to entice people back into the churches. We'll talk about the evangelical. UW professor has written a new biography of Rob Bell. That's all coming up today on Weekday on KUOW Seattle. I'm Steve Scherer. Thank you for being here. We're going to start with Joe Biden presenting his gun control reforms to the president. His package of gun legislation to lawmakers is emerging. President Obama is expected to announce details of his plan for gun control changes later in the week. Here's the president speaking yesterday.
My starting point is not to worry about the politics. My starting point is to focus on what makes sense, what works. What should we be doing to make sure that our children are safe and that we're reducing the incidence of gun violence?
Changes to gun laws would be difficult to move through Congress, most people are saying. The NRA is vowing a fight. We've already heard them marshaling their arguments. But it appears the focus of the administration's plan will be on executive actions taken by the president. John Hudak studies executive power at the Brookings Institution. John Hudak, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
John Hudak is a fellow in government studies. Governance studies. His research examines questions of presidential power in the midst and the context of administration changes, personnel, public policy. So if President Obama tries to go big on gun control, the narrative, you say, will quickly turn against him. Given that, how does he approach this topic?
Unfortunately, the president is in a tough position. He has a public policy issue problem that he sees a big fix would be ideal for. But unfortunately, if he tries a broad assault weapons ban or something like that, he's going to get so much opposition in Congress and so much opposition among interest groups that they'll likely dash any hopes he has at change. So what he needs to do is he needs to think small and think in the ways that he can get anything through Congress. Anything he can get through, he needs to try that and not go for the gold, essentially.
Well, the collection of measures, these 19 steps President Obama can take himself, are they the small steps you're talking about?
Some of them are. The administrative actions are 19 is a nice size number. In reality, the president is pretty limited on what he can do through executive action in this context because Congress is usually so explicit when they're legislating on gun control. And so there's very little discretion for the president to move on this, though some of these 19 steps are definitely those small steps. But there are small steps he can take with Congress as well.
What are those?
So there's a lot of public support behind some measures that have been floated out there so far. So a limit on the capacity of a magazine. This is something that Americans can really wrap their heads around, whether a gun needs to hold 6 bullets or needs to hold 60 bullets. That's something people can get behind. It's also pretty tough for an organization like the NRA to defend. It's easier for them to defend an assault or avoiding an assault weapons ban, but it's hard for them to have the presence to say, no, everyone should be able to have a gun that holds 30 or 50 bullets.
I hear them defending the assault weapons ban constantly, but you're saying that they wouldn't be able to defend a magazine because I heard Ann Coulter yesterday on Fox saying, Where were the other people who were armed if that person had to reload before he continued shooting? I don't remember how many bullets he had spent by then. So that's the kind of argument somebody like the president might make. Look, during the reloading, that makes sense. We can force people to reload.
Yeah, and plus, just from a logical perspective, if you have a gun that holds, you know, six bullets, let's say six or seven rounds, it makes sense that you would be able to defend yourself with that type of magazine, that you'd be able to hunt or whatever with that type of magazine. But you don't need a 50-round clip to hunt. You don't need a 50-round clip to defend yourself. It defies the logic of what is at the heart of the Second Amendment.
Tell me what you think in terms of power is going on here. You talked about that the president needs to take small steps, but how does he marshal his power in order to even – he'll get opposition from many of these 19 steps. He still has – like one of the ideas is for him to appoint somebody to head the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. So he's got all sorts of opposition. How does he marshal his power?
So this is tough, and I think the clip that you played at the beginning of this segment was an important one, where the president said, "My starting point is not to worry about the politics." And nothing could be a bigger mistake for the president. He has to think first about the politics. If he wants to get anything done, a thorny issue like gun control is all about the politics and your ability to get through it. So what the president needs to do is actually, he should hold off on these executive actions at first. Those executive actions will always be available to him. He has to let the legislative process try to make its way. And if it fails, perfect, he can institute the executive actions. If it succeeds, perfect, he can also institute the executive actions. But he has to let Congress try their work and do their work. And in terms of the appointee at the head of the ATF, this is going to be a great time to marshal the types of grassroots interest groups that are going to support this, as well as law enforcement interest groups that the president needs to rely more on to get a nominee through the Senate.
That's interesting what you say, to let Congress move forward. That implies that Congress will move forward soon. Can the president, given his power, given his status today, can he influence when Congress takes this up?
I think the president is in a really good position to do this right now. He has public opinion behind him. Public opinion isn't necessarily united on the what should be done in terms of a policy solution. But they are united in the sense that most people think something should be done. He has that. He has the ability to muster a grassroots movement. He, of course, has a remarkable list of campaign donors and volunteers who he can rely on. And he, as I said, he also needs to rely on individuals like law enforcement groups. And in a couple of weeks, he has the State of the Union address, and there's no grander platform to push Congress in a given direction.
John Hudak studies governance, presidential power, the Brookings Institution. So he's one of the things that he has talked about, as you mentioned, was more robust background checks for gun buyers. Does he let Congress move with that first, or does he have enough in his quiver to take some steps there?
So this is a difficult issue in the sense that there are ways in which he can direct additional resources to continue the types of registries and background checks that do occur and to help states implement these as well. But in terms of changing the requirements for a background check or the extent or the amount of information that's collected in a background check, that's generally something that's going to require legislative action and executive efforts to do that on his own are likely going to find some pushback in the courts because Congress is just so explicit in this area.
You know, the NRA, other gun rights groups, they talk about mental health. They talk about that we should deal with video game makers and others who promote violence in the culture. Does he take that argument up as a way to work with his opponents, or is that a no-win situation?
I think it's important that he takes it up. I'm not so sure it's important to signal that he's working with his opponents. I think he's going to have a lot more credibility in the public broadly, among swing voters, among moderates, and even among some conservatives, if he says, I want to solve a public policy problem, and the public policy problem is more than just guns. If he looks like another Democrat out to get our guns, he loses credibility with really key members in the public and really key members of Congress. But if he says, this is a broader problem, this is an issue of mental health, this is an issue of school safety, this is an issue of gun control, then he looks like he's truly trying to address something and not just being the typical Democrat, the typical way that Democrats are characterized by gun rights groups.
Of course, we've seen increased sales of all sorts of guns, including assault weapons, after the shootings at Sandy Hook. In part, perhaps people are concerned, and in part people are afraid that they're going to lose their access to these weapons. Given that, I mean, wouldn't anything else he does in mental health, in violence in the society, just look like a fig leaf, a covering, a feint to those people who are opposed to any restrictions on guns? I mean, again, this is about power, so how does he prove himself?
No, I think that's right. And the point on mental health issues is that if he offers this as a comprehensive reform package, then he might get a bit of additional support. But at the end of the day, everyone knows that this is going to be about guns. And he needs to show himself. He can't be the president who, after the Newtown shooting, just became the mental health care president or the school safety president. He needs to be the president who tried to get control of the weapons that caused this. And if he does that, he'll be successful and he'll be able to flex his muscle and show that he can do these things. But at the same time, this is such a difficult issue, he could also come away from this with nothing. And that's the real risk that the White House runs right now.
And working with the legislature might reduce that risk, you argue?
Yeah, I think so, at least in the short term. And also, if he tries his best, if he tries to be patient with Congress and tries to work closely with Congress to get something, and he fails, it can be more easily chalked up to the problems that are going on in Congress rather than a lack of effort on behalf of the administration. Now, that sort of clashes with what I said earlier about the challenge for the president not to go big. But at the same time, if he looks like he's played his hand poorly on this, he'll get some blame. If he looks like he played a good hand and still failed, then Congress is going to get the blame on this and for the future tragedies that we have.
You know, I just want to end with just this other point you're making, just to reiterate it. This is a quote from you in the Washington Times. The problem with gun control, as you said, is Congress has been extraordinarily explicit. When gun control legislation is passed, it's usually very detailed in what Congress intended. It's usually very detailed in the barriers it sets up for the executive branch. So given that it limits his authority, is in the end, is President Obama, his main tool is the bully pulpit?
I think so. I think the bully pulpit in a few ways, his own words, his own ability to capture camera attention, his ability to get important interest groups at the table, his ability to use the State of the Union in a strategic way, and finally his ability to rely on what got him a second term, and that was probably the most sophisticated grassroots effort in America's electoral history. If he can bring all those forces together in an effective way, he's going to be successful on this, and he's going to overcome the limitations on his own power. But if he fails to handle this in exactly the right way, and like I said earlier, having his starting point being about politics, then if he doesn't do that, he'll fail.
John Hudak, I appreciate you taking the time for the analysis.
Thanks for having me.
John Hudak is a fellow in governance studies. His research examines questions of presidential power in the context of administration, personnel, public policy. He is at the Brookings Institution. This is Weekday.
Gun control, a big issue these days, of course. Another big issue across the nation, unemployment. Job growth continues to be sluggish, but there's one big exception, temporary work. The number of temp and contract jobs has increased by nearly 30% since 2009. What does the rise of a new temping economy mean for American society, and what does it mean for you? We're going to get into that today at noon on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Alaska USA Federal Credit Union. For over three generations, Alaska USA members have shared the goal of helping each other get places worth going with savings accounts, loans, investments, insurance policies, and more. On the web at alaskausa.org.
39 degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle. A little bit of sun as well, forecast says. Expect clouds through the rest of the day, and we're probably not going to get out of the 30s. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:19. A little later this hour, a recommended hike to match the week's weather. That's 35 minutes away.
But first, let's take a look at the changing face of American Christianity. The way we practice religion is changing. We've seen the rise of evangelicals, non-denominational churches in recent years. The internet has turned charismatic leaders into celebrities, among them Rob Bell, an evangelical who Time magazine voted him one of 2011's most influential people. Who is Rob Bell? Well, here's a clip from one of his sermons. It's titled "Everything is Spiritual." It looks at the human tendency to never be still and present in the moment.
God says to Moses, "Moses, come up on the mountain and stay here." And the rabbis point out that the literal translation, that the word to stay is the word hayah. That means to be. The command literally reads, "Moses, come up on the mountain, and then when you get on top of the mountain, be on top of the mountain." Which is kind of like something from the school of redundancy school. I get it. If I'm on top of the mountain, I'm on top of the mountain. That's where I am. And the rabbis say, "Oh, no, 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 no. This command is brilliant." They say, "God understands human nature. God understands that Moses will spend all sorts of energy getting up to the top of the mountain. And when he gets to the top of the mountain, he'll immediately begin thinking and planning how he's going to get down. And in the process, he won't ever be fully present on top of the mountain, and he'll miss it."
Well, that sounds about right, doesn't it? James Wellman is associate professor and chair of comparative religion at the Jackson School of International Studies. He's been thinking about Rob Bell, and he's written a book, Rob Bell and a New American Christianity. Thank you for being here.
Great to be here.
He sounds like a funny guy. Who is he, and where did he? Actually, before I get there, Rob Bell, Mars Hill Church, yes?
Yeah, Rob Bell, Mars Hill Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. So right. This is not the Mark Driscoll Church of Mars Hill in Seattle. So those are two different folks and very different people.
Why is Mars Hill a church name that crops up around the country? Do you know? Is there something special about that Mars Hill?
It's from biblical times, and Paul was in Mars Hill and was talking about how God of Christ would relate to the secular public square. And I think that's where people get that sense.
And that God is, I looked it up, so that God is talking to the Stoics and the Epicureans and the non-believers, and he sees all sorts of faiths or non-faiths, given that it's Paul, represented. He says, you know, these are all fine and good, but these are all pathways to the one God, and really the one God is who you should be paying attention to. Is that a poor man's interpretation?
Yeah, in a sense. I think what he's trying to say is that there is a one presence and power at the center, and Paul has a sense that Christ is pointing that direction to that power.
And that all you other folks are maybe distracted.
Distracted or on the way, but not quite there.
I see. I ask because it seems like the Mars Hill, I mean, they're naming Mars Hill churches for a reason. Mm-hmm. And Rob Bell is emerging different from the Mark Driscoll Church, but are they all talking about the same thing at some point?
I think there's a sense in which contemporary culture or the feeling among evangelicals that the contemporary culture is very secular, and that in the midst of that secularity, there has to be a message from Christianity that can relate to those who are in a secular perspective.
I see. And Rob Bell is a good example of that.
Exactly. And it's interesting because I wrote the book and I heard his first sermon in 1999, Rob Bell's first sermon, very similar to the sermons that you hear from Mark Driscoll. What's interesting is that he took a pretty dramatic turn over the last decade away from a fairly rigorous conservative evangelicalism to I would call a more progressive evangelicalism. And many evangelicals think that Rob Bell walked away from his conservative Christian faith.
What happened? Do we know what the epiphany was for him, if there was one?
Well, very interesting. He started his church in 1999 in Grand Rapids, and he started with 1,000 people on the first Sunday. In a year and a half, he had 10,000 people coming to the church. For most megachurch pastors, this would be great success. For Rob Bell, he felt that there was something really deeply missing, and he sort of took a new perspective, and he went back to the Jewish roots of the New Testament, and he realized that the point of Christianity is not to get people from here to eternity, but back into the world to see God in the world and not God somewhere else.
He puts out a book called Love Wins. This is later after his transformation, and I guess this is part of what his change. But also this is what made him even more controversial. He questioned the place of heaven and hell in this this universe you're talking about.
Exactly. Within conservative Christianity, there's a sense in which if one is not converted to Christ, one is predestined for hell. And, thinking about conservative Christianity, they're more or less sending a good number, a high percentage of the world population to hell. I think Bell wanted to question that whole premise and basically say the God of the New Testament, what we see in the prodigal son, this God is a God who loves us unconditionally and loves all people, sinners, everyone, and always is inviting people back into his company. So this God is not waiting to send you to hell, but is waiting to give you new life and new creation in Christ.
Here's a clip, a promo for his book, Love Wins, by Rob Bell.
Several years ago, we had an art show at our church, and people brought in all kinds of sculptures and paintings, and we put them on display, and there was this one piece that had a quote from Gandhi in it. And lots of people found this piece compelling. They'd stop and sort of stare at it and take it in and reflect on it, but not everybody found it that compelling. Somewhere in the course of the art show, somebody attached a handwritten note to the piece, and on the note they had written, "Reality check, he's in hell." Gandhi's in hell? He is? And someone knows this for sure and felt the need to let the rest of us know? Will only a few select people make it to heaven? And will billions and billions of people burn forever in hell? And if that's the case, how do you become one of the few? And millions of people were taught that the primary message, the center of the gospel of Jesus, is that God is going to send you to hell unless you believe in Jesus. And so what gets subtly sort of caught and taught is that Jesus rescues you from God. But what kind of God is that, that we would need to be rescued from this God? How could that God ever be good? How could that God ever be trusted? And how could that ever be good news? What you discover in the Bible is so surprising, unexpected, and beautiful that whatever we've been told or taught, the good news is actually better than that, better than we could ever imagine.
Not just a few. All right, so that's Rob Bell promoting his book Love Wins, a book that shot up to the bestseller list and made some people mad. James Wellman has written a book about Rob Bell, Rob Bell and a New American Christianity. Why did he attract you? What's the newness of his Christianity? Because part of it's his message, and part of it, it seems, is how he has chosen to deliver his message.
Yeah, he's a fascinating figure. I chose him because I was doing a larger study in megachurches and came upon him, and he's quite different. He's unique. And that is, he really learned and changed and transformed during his ministry. And when you study him, as I did pretty much in depth over the last 10 or 12 years, you can see the changes. And these changes mean that he has a artistic point of view that he brings to the pulpit, brings to his writings, brings to his faith. And for him, as you saw in that clip, what he thinks is that in Christ, all things are made new. And everything that is true and good and beautiful is in Christ already. And so wherever you find what is true and good and beautiful, you find the Christ. And so for him, Gandhi, others, artistic works that are beautiful and true and good are what God is all about.
How has that message been received among the more, can I say, traditional evangelical churches in America?
You know, one of the reasons I wrote the book, too, is that I think there's many different subcultures within evangelicalism. And I think evangelicals are beginning to rethink their own faith. And so there's a lot of evangelicals, especially younger generation of evangelicals, who are listening to alternative voices. And Rob Bell is one of those alternative voices. However, as you pointed out, Love Wins in 2011 really was a breaking point for especially older evangelicals. When Bell questioned heaven and hell, that's the breaking point for many of them, and they simply kicked him out of the nest, as they
literally.
Well, I think Bell got such a harsh response from some evangelicals that I think there's a sense in which he sort of walked away. And, you know, he's walking away to Hollywood to begin to work on TV shows. And that sounds kind of crazy. But if you look at his life story, you look at the kind of person he was, he takes big risks. And this is yet another risk that he's taking.
He's working in Hollywood with some of the creators of Lost.
Exactly.
Who did end the show with a very faith-based, Christian-based message. So I guess it makes some sense. What does he want to accomplish there?
You know, Rob Bell has always been about compellingly communicating the gospel. And he is a performer. And he told me that from the beginning. That's what he loves. And the bigger the stage, the better. And so for him to go to Hollywood and to work with Carlton Kuse, the producer of Lost, is what he really dreamed of doing. And so they had a TV show that was sold and was not piloted, and they're now working on a Rob Bell talk show that has spiritually inflected kind of conversations. And we'll see what happens. It's a big risk, and we'll see if he is able to pull it off. But he's the kind of guy that I can imagine might be able to do it.
So Time magazine names him one of the 100 most influential people in the world. He's got these Numa videos. He has spread his message through YouTube and others, other venues. What makes him influential beyond the people he's talking to now? What makes him influential in the world?
You know, it's always a big question as to the future of any kind of cultural figure. And I think for now, he's been very powerful within the evangelical community. I think he's reaching beyond that community now. And as I talk about in the book and the conclusion, I think he's kind of presenting a religionless Christianity.
Yeah.
And
what does that mean?
You know, it's very interesting, and I hope people read the book because they'll find out. But what he means by this is that religion separates the sacred and the profane. And what Bell believes is that in Christ, that separation is no longer true. Everything is sacred. Everything is true and beautiful in God. Now, the problem with that is that once you say everything is sacred and true, you know, then you wonder, okay, if everything is, then how do we distinguish what is holy? And that's a problem. But that's the problem he wants to look at. And for many people, that's a very powerful message, especially for spiritual but not religious folks. But that's where Rob Bell is going, and that's where his thinking has taken him.
Yeah, I'm back on top of Mars Hill with Paul again because he's looking at this monument, this idol to false gods. So is Rob Bell saying, oh, that's not a false god?
I'm trying
to think how it means in the faith.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. I'm not sure we know where it's going. He would say this, is that the church may be behind where God is, and the culture may be actually – God may be in the culture leading the church into a new horizon. And that's a very challenging and very,
Rob Bell sounds like he's from the 70s.
You know, that there's something to that. But he certainly, you know, I will say this, is that he believes that the story of Christianity, the story of Christ, is a, you know, I'm not sure if he would say this, but is a better story. It is a beautiful story. And so he has not given up the story of the faith, but he's simply interpreting it in quite different ways.
Rob Bell accepts gays as people, as well as people in his church?
Yeah, I think he you know, this, of course, in the evangelical community, this is very controversial. He has not, how should I put it, come out and said that. He has said that he has gay friends et cetera.
Oh, he has not gone as far as to say gay marriage is something we accept in our church?
No, he's not an advocate in that sense. So he's pretty careful about what he says.
I see. I was reading a quote that said there are brothers, there are sisters, but that's not quite the same as taking them all the way into the door, through the door, huh?
Oh, I think he would. I think he's pretty careful because once he says, for instance, he's for gay marriage, you know, 75% of evangelicals will turn him off. So there may be some consciousness of market here.
Well, how about that aspect of market? How important are his videos and his books? You know, we sometimes think of evangelicals, I sometimes think of evangelicals as people who are in the market making money. Is he one of those people? And is it important to him?
You know, I think he wants to, you know, make a living and support his family. You know, that's a question in the book. Is he a hypocrite? And he's certainly a charismatic figure. But what I say back to that is that the enormous good that he did in the 12 years in his ministry is really amazing. $20 million in direct care and charity. He never remodeled or built a new cathedral. They were given a $1 mall and moved into it, set up chairs, and they stayed there. So he left the church without debt. He lived in a ghetto in Grand Rapids for 2 years. He really set the church up as a servant to others. And, you know, you can tell a person by their fruits, and they did a lot of good at Mars Hill.
James Wellman has written a book about Rob Bell, the evangelical, Rob Bell and a New American Christianity. James Wellman's a professor at the Jackson School in Comparative Religion. All right, leave me with this. One, the other way you can tell a person is his influence on other up-and-coming members of the church, other people starting churches. What influence has Rob Bell had in the evangelical community?
You know, one of the extraordinary things is that he said this to me, basically. I said, Rob, do you want to be a leader of a social movement? And he doesn't. He rejected all labels, the emergent church. He rejected being a conservative evangelical, or any label. And he's also a person who never talks about other people. He never mentioned any other leaders, any other influences on his life in particular. So he's really, he's an unusual character. And I think he sees himself as an artist in that sense. So he's not really looking to be a social movement maker. So in that sense, who knows what his real influence will be? I think that really remains to be seen.
He sounds like a very modern person in that sense, in all the ways that you describe him.
Yeah, I think so. Some people would say that he is of his generation, and that he's both humble and dramatically ambitious. And it's a fascinating combination, and I spent a lot of time trying to think of who this guy really is.
James Wellman's book is Rob Bell and a New American Christianity. I appreciate you talking to us.
Yeah, great being with you.
He'll be at the University Bookstore tonight talking about Rob Bell and some of these issues at 7 p.m. This is Weekday.
Degrees in Seattle with clouds and some sun. Forecast says we should expect clouds through the day, and we probably won't get out of the 30s.
Support for KUOW comes from the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley and its evening and weekend MBA program, offering a Saturday option for full-time working professionals from outside the Bay Area to earn a Berkeley MBA. Seattle information session on January 30th. More information at haas.berkeley.edu.
We've got to know there are forces that govern our lives that we will never understand or control. We've got to know that we emerged from nature, and when we die, we go back to nature. We're part of that natural cycle. That there are places that are sacred that we go with respect and reverence, not looking for opportunity. We need to have that sense of our place. This is not a religious sense, but in a spiritual sense in the universe.
Scientist and environmental activist David Suzuki on The Nature of Things, tomorrow night at 8 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Symphony, presenting Bach and Telemann on January 18th and 19th at Benaroya Hall, featuring Handel's Overture from the Occasional Oratorio, Telemann's Wassermusik, and J.S. Bach's Suite for Orchestra No. 4. Tickets at seattlesymphony.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:40. A new report on climate change says not only is the climate changing, it's changing rapidly. We'll talk about it with a climate change scientist in 25 minutes.
Now a sort of a follow-up to that conversation about Rob Bell. Professor Wellman and I were just talking about how younger people are looking at the world around them, and all the baby boomers, even the ones from the Estean era and Gestalt era, kind of plugging up the works. And younger people, this generation of 20- and 30-year-olds, have to make their own way. They have to be entrepreneurs. They have to sell their ideas. And James Wellman was saying that, for example, the Christian church maybe is not mainstream, and that it has to, again, sell itself to people, sell their ideas to each of us. So are we all in sales at some point, selling each other transactionally our beliefs, our clarity, our value? Dan Pink is the author of 4 books about the changing world of work, but he's really looking at how we relate to one another. His books included A Whole New Mind and Drive. His new book is called To Sell is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. And basically he argues that we're all in sales now, that we relate to each other and talk to each other, but what we're really doing through all those times is trying to promote our ideas and have the other person see us sympathetically so we can see them sympathetically.
A, B, C. A, always, B, B, C, closing. Always be closing. Always be closing.
So that's our standard idea, Dan Pink, of what sales was like. But no, not anymore, and not that ABC from Glengarry Glen Ross.
No, not at all. One of the epic scenes in the cinema of sales, where he goes in there and he schools these guys on how to be effective. A, always, B, B, C, closing. And that steamroller approach worked for one era. It doesn't work so well anymore. That worked for an era when sellers had a lot more information than buyers, and therefore they could steamroller you by always being closing. Now I think there's a different set of qualities that are necessary in selling. And what's also interesting is that more of us are selling, whether we're selling Buicks or whether we're selling ideas.
All right, so that's where I want to push back on you, and you will then respond. Is that the world we want to construct? Because we construct the worlds we live in.
Sure.
A world where we're always in transactions that have win-wins or win-losses. Isn't it about what's moral, what's right? How can we move together?
Absolutely. I think that human life, human existence is about those things. I think what's interesting is that there is right now in the world of sales, in the world of persuasion, I think arguably in the world, certain aspects of the world of business, an affinity between humanistic values that you're talking about of doing the right thing, of acting with a sense of purpose, and also effectiveness in business. It used to be that in the old days of, let's say, sales, that duplicity was actually effective. Now, duplicity is hardly effective at all. It's forcing people to the high road. Now, we can have a very interesting philosophical conversation about whether you know, if people are being forced into moral behavior, whether that's actually truly moral behavior. But I think what we're seeing now throughout many aspects of business, not all, is a kind of convergence between being good and being effective.
When you talk about that, we're, 9 out of 9 of us are in sales. when I go to a coffee shop,
yeah,
and I buy something from a barista,
right.
The barista is in sales with me because she wants me to have a pleasant experience.
Sure.
She would like a tip.
Sure.
She would like to know that I would come back. And I'm with her because I want her to see me as a good customer, as somebody worthy of giving good service to.
Yeah.
Is that the essence of what you're talking about,
or part
is there
of it.
More?
Well, that's part of it.
What's the rest?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. That's we can be slightly. I mean, as you said, 9 out of 9 people are in sales. So what the truth is that 1 out of 9 people in the workforce, 1 out of 9 workers, are in sales. Sales. Their job is to try to get someone to buy stuff: real estate agents, car dealers, and so forth. But if you look at what those other 8 and 9 do, they are also in kind of a form of sales. They're trying to convince other people, persuade other people, influence other people, make some kind of an exchange. That's what you do on – and to some extent, that's what we're doing right now in our conversation.
We are doing that. And that's, yeah. That's what we do on public radio, and that's what we're doing now.
Absolutely.
But is it a sale? I guess, and maybe I'm hung up on the notion of what a sale is.
Well, I think that's actually a really good point, because we are hung up on this notion of sales, because sales has such terrible connotations. It really has such terrible connotations. And in this book, To Sell is Human, I'm actually trying to take that on directly, even in the title of the book itself, because I think that our view of sales as sleazy, slimy, smarmy, and that's the associations that many of us have with sales, embodied very nicely in that clip that you played at the top, embodied in basically every piece of American popular culture or high culture dealing with salespeople. But I think that view of sales is about the conditions in which sales have taken place rather than the act of making that exchange itself. It's really about a world where the seller had an information asymmetry advantage and could rip people off. Now, sellers of anything don't have that advantage of information asymmetry. It's true for you, Steve, in this. You could make a claim on the show, and 20 years ago, people, oh, my God, Steve said it on public radio, the gospel. Now, you can make a claim, and someone could post a blog or a tweet or something like that.
Oh,
and say,
it happens.
And you know what? Like, here's the link to the data showing that this guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
That's right. So have we evolved as a culture to where we are all watchdogs over each other?
Well, I mean, it's a mix of those things. I mean, if you just look at what people do, what we're trying to do is we're trying to influence people. We hope, I think, largely for good, not always for good, but we're trying to influence people. We're trying to get people to see things our way. We're trying to marshal resources. That's what human beings do. And I think what's interesting now is that the conditions in which people do it have changed, and it calls for a very different set of qualities. We talk about Glengarry Glen Ross, ABCs of always be closing. What I found is that there's a different set of ABCs, attunement, buoyancy, and clarity, that actually are very – go back to our earlier part of our conversation, these fundamentally human characteristics and values that make us more effective in doing these things.
Dan Pink is the author of 4 books about changing world of work, including Whole New Mind, Drive, his new book, To Sell Is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. All right, so give those – attunement is –
attunement is perspective taking. So can you look at something? Can you look at a situation from another person's point of view? Can you understand their interests and ultimately toward serving their interests? And there's some very interesting research in the social science about how human beings do this and how all of us can get better at it. If you're trying to convince, persuade, influence somebody, the starting point is to see the world from their point of view. And what social science tells us is that there's some interesting ways to do that.
Which are the ways to do it that are always honest?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because many of them are perfectly honest. I'll give you an example. What the research on attunement, on perspective taking, shows is an inverse relationship between power and perspective taking. There's experiments where people are primed to feel a sense of power. And when people feel powerful, they actually aren't very good at taking another's perspective. And so what you can do in an encounter, whether you're talking to a listener, whether you're trying to convince your son or daughter to practice an instrument, whether you are asking somebody out on a date, whatever, is to in this encounter, say to yourself, you know what? maybe I'm not the most powerful. Maybe I'm not the powerful person here. Maybe I actually need to think about who's really powerful here. Maybe I need to, in some level, something that we're not very good at, lower my status a little bit. If you're a boss talking to an employee, say, you know what? Even though I'm the boss, maybe I'm not the powerful person here. And that allows you to see things from other people's perspective.
When you say not the powerful person, do you mean that the other person is powerful or that you're lowering your Did you say standards? Lowering your status.
I've lowered my standards many times.
Lowering your status.
Lowering your status. But it's something that's kind of internal. It's basically your perspective. If you go in there, if you're the boss, and I'm the boss, you're the employee. If I go in there thinking to myself, I'm the boss, I don't really need to listen, I can fire this guy whenever I want, you're actually going to be a pretty bad boss.
Yes.
But if I go in there and say, you know what, even though I'm the boss, maybe this employee needs, maybe I need him more than he needs me. And that small reframing can allow you to see things from someone else's perspective and actually reach a conclusion that's better for both sides.
So that's attunement.
That's attunement,
awareness aspect. So buoyancy is you say learn from life insurance salespeople and social scientists.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Buoyancy. Okay, so here's what's interesting. In this book, I spend part of my time with a character named Norman Hall, who is the last Fuller Brush salesman in San Francisco. Now, most people under 40 have no recollection of the Fuller Brush Man, but there was a time in this country when Fuller Brush Men were ubiquitous. In fact, in the 1950s, one year, the Fuller Brush Men, and they were almost always men, made 50 million sales calls in America at a time when there were 43 million households. It's unbelievable. And so anyway, but they're pretty much gone, but I found one guy still doing it. It was a really fascinating dude named Norman Hall. And what he said about sales, he's been doing this for 40 years. He said, when you're in sales, and I think it applies to sales, I think it applies to any effort to influence, persuade, convince people. He says you deal with, and this is his lovely phrase, an ocean of rejection. An ocean of rejection. And we can once again look to social science to say, how do we stay afloat in that ocean of rejection? So there are all kinds of interesting things. For instance, before an encounter, let's say you're going into an important sales call or an important meeting where you're pitching something. The instinct is to, in our self-talk, is to pump ourselves up. Say, Dan, you can do this. You're a monster. You got this. But it turns out that the research shows you're better off actually using what's called interrogative self-talk. And instead say, Dan, can you do this? Now, all the self-help gurus will say, wait a second, this is sacrilege. You can't let this shaft of doubt into your room. And what this research shows is that when people ask the question, can you do this, rather than you can do this, questions are active. Questions require an active response. And so if I say, Dan, you can do this, say I'm coming into this interview, Dan, you can do this, all right? I feel awesome because I feel like telling myself I'm awesome, and I feel awesome when I tell myself I'm awesome. But I'm better off doing this. Dan, can you do this? Why? Because the questions by their nature elicit a response. And so what happens? I begin preparing myself in a more muscular way for the encounter rather than merely affirming myself.
Clarity, the capacity to make sense of murky situations.
You know, we used to have this world of information asymmetry where if the seller had more information than the buyer. So you go into a Chevy dealership. The Chevy deal 20 years ago, the Chevy dealer knows a lot more about cars than you can. Knows a lot more about Chevys. Now you go into a Chevy dealer, you've got a lot of information about cars. You have as much information as he or she has. In fact, what you might have is too much information. And so clarity is the capacity to take this massive welter of information and separate the signal from the noise, distill it for meaningful units. And the other thing that clarity is about, it's about how you frame messages so that they're effective and clarifying for people. It's also about moving from the skill of problem solving. We tend to think that solving problems is the most important skill in any sort of effort. But it turns out now that if your customer, your prospect, the person across the other side of the table knows precisely what their problem is, they can probably find the solution. Where you're more valuable is identifying problems they don't realize that they have. Going two steps down the road and saying, hey, when you turn this corner, this is the problem you're going to face. And so there's a premium now throughout the workforce. Problem solving still matters, but problem finding is a much more valuable skill today.
And again, it has to be a real skill, right? The falseness in sales can be where people manufacture problems.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But I think what's interesting about that is here's the thing. People can always take the low road. It's not like the low road has been plowed under, but the low road doesn't go very far anymore. Because if you do that, all right, manufacturer problem, that you realize down the road that you've been ripped off, you're not going back there. Think about the Music Man, all right? The Music Man used to go from, you know, in that play, he would rip somebody off, go to a new city. Try that today, all right? They'd have a Facebook post up, and they'd be waiting for you when you cross the border to the next town. Here's the thing. What's so interesting about this is that this world from the Glengarry Glen Ross always be closing to what I think is this new world of attunement, buoyancy, and clarity. That's it. It's we've gone from a world of buyer beware to a world of seller beware. The seller has to beware. It used to be that buyers had limited choices, not very much information, and no means to talk back. Now they've got lots of choices, lots of information, and all kinds of means to talk back. So that doesn't make it a perfect world at all. But what it does is that it pushes more and more people to the high road if they want to have anything sustainable.
That's Dan Pink, who thinks about selling and sales. Relate that back to Rob Hill, if you would, won't you? Dan Pink is the author of To Sell, Rob Bell. Though Rob Wood might want to have it be related to him, too. Dan Pink is author of To Sell Is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. Michael Fagan is getting us moving in a hike. Or, I guess in this sense, Michael Fagan, perhaps a snowshoe. Is that right?
That's right. The hike, or I should say snowshoe this time, is what we call Dome Peak, just east of Enumclaw. I've done this hike 6 different years, and this is actually the first year we needed snowshoes. So this is a indication that the snowpack is above normal at lower elevations. This hike starts out at about 1,500 feet, so bring your snowshoes. And you'll see from the blog, one of the highlights is seeing that giant golf ball. Now my friend had a zoom-in camera and got a picture of it. And I did some research. It's a ground-based radar unit that we're looking at. It's part of the missile defense unit. So it's pretty interesting, but keep out of the fence area. But it makes it for an interesting view. And also, we talked about views this week. Next week, we're looking at continued dry weather, sunny conditions, especially in the mountains. And this hike offers views of Mount Rainier as well as the White River. And the mileage is reasonable. It's 4 miles one way. You can certainly go further or shorter for that matter. Elevation gain is about 1,500 feet. And the maps is Green Trails Map 237 and 238. And to have access into this area requires a Hancock permit, and I have information on that on my blog. And also on my blog, we have a contest of guessing the strongest wind gust at SeaTac this month. You'll win a flashlight that also, I should say, you'll win a lantern that converts into a flashlight. So that's a neat little prize.
Have you had any entries yet?
Yes. We've had a lot of entries, and the deadline is the 21st.
Yeah, it's coming up. Michael Fagan finds a hike for us. He's part of West Coast Weather LLC, where he helps people around the world figure out the weather for hikes and other expeditions. His blog, hikewashington.net, where he has this hike set up, and this looks pretty safe. Not a lot of avalanche danger. Just a nice flat road and nice ski or snowshoe.
Right. Now, skiing, since we haven't had any new snow lately, it's going to be a little crunchy for skiing. You can certainly try it. Snowshoes will be better, that's for sure. But, yeah, no avalanche issues, just a real nice open area. And, like I said, plenty of sun. And actually, it will be interesting this week. We have a temperature inversion where the temperature will be warmer in the higher elevation. So it will actually be warmer up in the mountains than in the city for much of this week.
Wow, that's very interesting. I have to experience that. All right, Michael, I hope you have had a good hike and you'll have some more for us or snowshoes next week as well, yeah?
We'll be working on it this week.
And don't forget that contest, hikewashington.net. You can win a lantern converts to a flashlight. You'll see the rules at hikewashington.net. Thanks a lot, Michael.
You bet.
And now, the sound of the day.
reminders, summer. Bees. Tim is inspecting his beehive. They were calm, and then they get a little angry and a little more intense. Did you hear that? Yeah. When you hear the bees get angry, that was the moment when he swept a good number of the bees off the frame that he was looking at. The angry bees of summer. If you have some angry or happy sounds, share them with us. Sounds from winter, that would be great. Maybe snowshoes picking up rocks or something. Send us 30 seconds of it. Send it to weekday@kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. Climate change and corals coming up.
39 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy, a little bit of blue sky, but it is mostly cloudy. Forecast says expect clouds through the day, temperatures in the upper 30s.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Hubbard Street Dance Chicago, performing two works by Israeli choreographers, February 9th.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.